This is The Radical Therapist, a space where we explore the intersections of collaborative therapy, philosophy, art, and science and technology in a post-Freud, post-psychology world.
Welcome to The Radical Therapist. This is your host, Chris Hoff. We are now at episode number 67. And as always, thanks for listening. Thanks for tuning in. Got a good one. I got a great one for you today. We have a repeat guest, Dr. Sean Davis. Some of you loyal listeners that have been listening for a while might remember me talking to him about common factors in family therapy. Great. If you haven't heard it, go back and listen to it. It's a great podcast. But today, Dr. Sean Davis is back, and we're talking about his new article out, What Does It Mean to Be a Common Factors Informed Therapist, that he wrote with Alexander Shea, I think is how that's pronounced. We're going to go back. This is an article, you know, if you go back to the last podcast, we were talking about common factors more theoretically. Here, the work is now being moved into what it might look like practice, what it might look like in practice to be a common factors informed family therapist. So it's just a rich conversation about moving these ideas into the realm of practice. So excited about that. But before we get there, two quick announcements. For those of you that are subscribed to the YouTube channel, there's a new Radical Therapist YouTube video up where I did a video on why we can't admit we're wrong, which is a video around why mental health professionals have a hard time admitting mistakes when with clients. And I think you'll find that worthwhile. That's at the Radical Therapist YouTube channel. So please go check that out. Share it with somebody if you like it. Comment, leave me a comment. And of course, please subscribe to the Radical Therapist YouTube channel. So go check that out. I would love your impressions, comments. It would be great to hear. And secondly, if you have an opportunity, please, if you're on your smartphone right now or on your laptop on iTunes, please go rate and review the show. That's how we get out in front of people, they tell me. So we'd really appreciate you rating and reviewing the show if you could take a moment and do that. So that would be much appreciated. So those are my announcements. Let's get to the show and let's get to Sean Davis. So Dr. Sean Davis earned his BA in Family Studies and his MS in Marriage and Family Therapy at Brigham Young University. He earned his PhD in Marriage and Family Therapy at Virginia Tech and completed a postdoctoral fellowship at the University of Kentucky. Dr. Davis' work focuses on common factors of effective marriage and family therapy treatments. He is widely published in this area, most notably having co-authored the first book on this subject and two articles for which he and his co-authors received the 2014 and 2015 Article of the Year Award in the Journal of Marital and Family Therapy, his field's top journal, and that's quite an accomplishment right there. Dr. Davis is also the co-author with Dr. Michael Nichols of Family Therapy, Concepts and Methods, one of the field's most widely used theory textbooks. I'm sure people listening to this podcast have used that textbook. And in addition to his work on common factors, Dr. Davis enjoys international education opportunities, having taken students to Mexico and Italy, and he's got some workshops coming up as well that we'll talk about in the podcast, so stay tuned for that. But without further ado, let's meet our guest, Dr. Sean Davis. All right, Sean, welcome back to the Radical Therapist Podcast.
Thank you, Chris. Glad to be here. Appreciate the repeat invite.
Yeah, you know, I think you're my first repeat guest, as a matter of fact. So
I'll take it. Thank you.
Yeah, it's great to have you back. I love your work, and I think you're doing interesting stuff, and I love sharing it with others. And so we're back. You just released a new article in the journal Family Process titled, What Does It Mean to Be a Common Factors Informed Therapist? And the last time you were on the podcast, we talked basically theoretically about common factors. And here's a paper where you're moving more into praxis or practice. And so I thought it would make a lot of sense to have you back and kind of let's talk about what it means to be a common factors informed family therapist. But I think before we kind of get into the details, I'm wondering if we can start by having you give our audience maybe again a summary of the idea of common factors and what they are.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I think the way I've been talking about this lately is taking a massive step back from our field. And the analogy I like to use is called an alien observer. Like, pretend you are an alien sent down from outer space to kind of learn about humanity. And your specific job is to learn about how humanity copes with their problems. Like, when a person is having a problem that they can't quite figure out how to solve themselves, what do they do? Where do they go? And over time, which we'll circle back to this part later in the podcast probably, but over time, there have been a lot of different methods for doing that. Lately, since, you know, the Freudian era, the humanity has come up with this thing we call therapy, that is supposedly a scientifically based way of, we use science as kind of the foundation to help people with their problems. And so you as the alien come down, you look at that and you try to see if it works, and you follow it, you watch people go through it, all of that stuff. And what common factors are essentially is what the alien reports back and says, this is what makes it work. Yeah, they have this therapy thing. It seems to work. And here are the elements unique to this thing they're doing that makes it work. So that is, in a nutshell, what the common factors movement aims to understand of this thing we're doing called therapy. What is it about it that makes it work? Is it justified? You know, what justifies its existence, basically?
Yeah. And can you kind of give us maybe a quick summary of what some of those, just for people that haven't, are first sure. hearing about what common factors might be?
Yes. So for the original person who came up with this was Michael Lambert, or there have been several, but he's the one that began talking about it the most. And he came up with four common factors. He has client and extra therapeutic factors, which are basically traits, habits, personalities, et cetera, intrinsic to the client. So what, you know, is the client going to be working really hard to solve this problem? That type of thing. Extra therapeutic factors, meaning things outside of their of therapy, sort of like job situations, health concerns, etc. And Lambert made the case that shifts in those things often have more, he said, to do with outcome of therapy than therapy itself. So that's one, and we'll circle back to that more later.
Sure.
Alliance factors, like therapeutic alliance, do you get along well? Are you working on the same thing? That type of thing. And then hope and expectancy factors. Does the client expect to get better? Sort of like the placebo in medicine. And then lastly, and thought that Lambert claims to be the smallest of these, is our model and technique factors. So things attributable solely to a particular model or a particular technique.
Got it.
Yeah.
And then we'll talk a little bit about that, I'm sure, too. But
yeah, we'll circle back to all that.
Yeah. Before we go on, in your new paper, you acknowledge that critics charge that merely being familiar with lists of common factors does little to guide treatment. And I think that's been the common critique of common factors. And I wonder if you could say a little bit more about that.
Sure. Yeah, that has been the critique, is that, okay, great. So you have this list of four common factors. So what, you know?
Right.
Here I am, a new therapist trying to learn how to do therapy. You give me this list of four common factors and say, there you go, you know, knock yourself out. It's not really helpful. Anyone who's done therapy for more than a few minutes knows there's a lot more to it than just being able to know four things. So On one hand, I think that's a fair critique. On the other hand, though, I think that is a critique based on not fully understanding what common factors are. And some of that is I think misunderstanding, and some of that I think is the fault of common factors researchers such as myself, in that we have not fully clarified what that what it means to be a common factors therapist. And so that's what I hoped to accomplish with this paper, or at least the conversation I hoped to start.
Yeah.
People interested.
Yeah. And I think, and you, this is, you know, you taking a step in that direction. So I guess now it's really time to ask, you know, how do you conceptualize a common factors informed therapist? I in the article, you propose that, you know, common factors of individual and family therapy result in an approach to family therapy characterized by six foundational principles, and you really break them out. And I was wondering if, you know, now at this point we could just kind of go through those six principles that make for a common factors informed family therapist.
Yeah, sure. So the first one is, this is basically, these principles I say are, when you are saying you are a common factors therapist, and I would see this a lot as I would go around and present to people, you know, give presentations on common factors or whatever. Mm-hmm. I would hear people say, "Oh, I love your stuff. I'm a common factors therapist." And I would say, "Interest. Okay, great. I'm glad you like it. Tell me what you mean by that." And the answers to that would vary really widely. Which spoke, you know, helped me realize we've got to get some unity here to this. And so the first thing, what most people meant with that is, well, I pay really close attention to the alliance, right, which is great, but there's more to it than that.
Right.
So I came up with six things. I didn't come up with them. I kind of synthesized this from the literature to try to get some cohesion here. And the first of the six is seeing overlap among theories. A common factors family therapist sees overlap among theories. And I want to really clarify how we as a common factors therapists think about theory. We don't think of theory as bad. That's a common misconception.
Right.
And we don't ignore theory, definitely. In fact, I think of theory as a really indispensable part of family therapy. I'm the co-author on one of the field's largest most widely used theory textbooks. So I'm the last person that's going to be decrying theory. We do differ, however, in the way we think about theory. So we don't think of theory as, say, gospel, or like you found the right church, like there's one theory that's better than all of the others.
Right.
We think about theory primarily in terms of, is it useful? Does this particular approach resonate with this particular family? And if so, then great. Use it. Keep going with it until it doesn't. And then, you know, change your approach, or maybe even with different clients, changing the theory that you use. And so what we advocate for in the common factors world is that therapists become master many different theories, and so that they can change the way that they, or so they can use different theories with different clients based on client feedback. Now that is sort of a career long goal. It's not something, whenever I mention that to master's students, they get really overwhelmed. Like, no, don't worry. I'm talking about a mindset to carry over your career rather than something to accomplish in a training program or before your license or something like that.
Right.
Like a discrete time. So as it's, in relation to overlap, seeing overlap among theories, I would say the best example is a story that from my training. When I was in my master's program, I was taking a class on postmodernism, and my professor had come up with her own postmodern approach, Dr. Wendy Watson. And she was explaining that. And she had, as part of her approach, she drew from a lot of Foucault and Maturana and a lot of those folks. As part of her approach, she had something she called core beliefs, and that a person has these core beliefs. And she said, you can tell how when you are getting close to a core belief based on their expression of emotion, they will start to get either really angry or they'll start to cry or something, but it's like there's this emotion guarding it. And when you get close, the emotion comes out. And what you're supposed to do in that case, she said, was go and really ask them a bunch of questions that are kind of inductive, gentle questions to help them kind of unpack that belief and have a different experience with it that wasn't so triggering and emotional. So I thought, all right, fair enough. Sounds good. Then I went to my next class, which was a class on psychoanalysis taught by a Jungian professor. So about as far on the other end of the philosophical continuum as you could get, right?
Right.
And so I'm listening to him, and he's explaining the Jungian concept of a complex. And he said, what a complex is this cluster of very strong emotions attached to an archetype on a person's unconscious. And so this person will have had something happen to them at some point that their conscious mind is not able to deal with. And so their unconscious hangs on to it, represses it, and it is whenever that person then encounters the archetype that is associated with this, all of that pent up emotion will come out and just flood out. And what you're supposed to do in this case when that happens is you're supposed to just start asking a lot of very gentle, inductive questions, trying to find out what's happening, help them unpack this belief, help them become more aware of it, integrate it into their consciousness, to their conscious mind, so their unconscious isn't hanging on to it. You can see where I'm going. I thought, wait a minute, that's what my postmodern professor, that's the exact same process she was just saying. You guys used very different words. You have a very different, like, theoretical conceptualization of what's going on. But what the process you described and the kind of symptoms or the display that I see in my client and what I do when I see that is exactly the same. So what if I just, if we just, you know, delete all of your model specific words here, your lingo, your jargon, you're talking about the same thing. That's what I am talking about when a common factors therapist sees overlap among theories. When they see, they can look at what is going on with a client and they can see what is needed, and they know their theories well enough to know how the different theories are going to look at this particular thing. And pretty much all theories, I would say, have some degree of overlap. And then they move forward. The reason this is relevant is when they move forward with the client to address whatever particular pattern or process they're seeing, if they know many different theories, they can choose one that works resonates the most with that particular client. That's pretty much what I mean by the first principle, which is they see overlap among theories, and that's why it's relevant.
Yeah. Great. Your next point, I really appreciate, and I can really get behind. And this is this idea of passionate about theory, not a theory. And, yeah. You know, we were talking before we hit record, and I was telling you, and I'm going to say it out loud, but, you know, I love theory. I'm a theory freak. And, yeah. And actually, the theory that I tend to listen to, I don't share this publicly. It's coming out of the closet, so to speak. I listen to a lot of podcasts that deal with like psychoanalytic theory and theories that just would sit outside of some of the post-structuralist theory and stuff that I kind of tend to operate in it. And so I just like theory. I'm passionate about theory. And I'm wondering if you could say how you conceptualize that piece.
Yeah. But first of all, you heard it here first, everyone. Chris right. Hoff, the diehard narrative therapist, just admitted he listens to psychoanalytic podcasts.
I do. Yep.
Yeah. How are you feeling right now, by the way? Pretty vulnerable.
I'm okay. I feel lighter.
Yeah. Good. He's out of the closet.
Yeah.
That kind of fits. This next one, actually, the next principle is they're passionate. A common factors therapist is passionate about theory, not a theory. Mm-hmm. I think, and it has been my experience, that theoretical dogma always goes awry. Like the more religious and the more dogmatic a person gets about their theory, the more they unwittingly tend to model what that theory describes as dysfunction.
Yeah.
And I remember we talked about this on the last podcast.
We did. And it rings so true to me too, in my own experiences. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So like an EFT therapist will become very insecurely attached to their theory, you know, and if you challenge it in any way, it's like they fly off the handle, you know,
right.
Or rather than just letting it, you know, go out and get kicked around a bit.
Well, in the postmodern world, there is no truth except what I'm about to tell you.
Except postmodernism. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
All stories are fine as long as it's my story.
Yeah, right. But there's one that's better than the rest.
Right. As long as it's congruent with postmodern principles.
Yep.
Yeah. So, but you can get lost in that and you get carried away with that. To me, the important part is a theory useful? And the way you determine if a theory is useful is if it's resonating with a client and if it's helping a client through their life. So go to your trainings, do all your stuff, do all of that, but don't listen to the dogma part. Just listen to the knowledge part. Soak up as much knowledge as you can about theories, because essentially what a theory is a... it's a roadmap. It's a way of making sense of what's going on. And when a client comes into therapy, usually by definition, the whole reason they've come in is because they've kind of exhausted their own critical thinking abilities. They're like, I've looked at this from every angle I can think of, and I don't know what to do. Mm-hmm. Here I am. And what a theory does is helps ensure that you are not in that same place, that you don't have that same level of confusion. A theory helps you know what to pay attention to in their world, in that client's world, of all the things coming at you that they're saying. It helps you know which ones to accentuate, which ones to ignore, that type of thing. And it helps you, it gives you confidence as a therapist that you can meet their maybe panic or their concern or their anxiety about their state. You can meet that with a sense of calm and of peace, because to you, you're not so worried about it. You like, I've seen this. I know how to make sense of this. That I think is one of the main values of the theory, is it gives order and calm it gives calm through giving the sense, through giving the therapist a sense of order. And so
that's a great way of putting it, actually. Even in my own experience, I feel like because I know a model, I don't get lost, right?
Or,
and I think exactly. that's a great way of putting it. And
thank you.
Yeah, and I guess you also write that common factors paradigm is often misunderstood as disparaging of models of therapy, but you take on that idea a little bit.
Yeah, I don't disparage them at all. In fact, I think they're a vital piece of the therapeutic endeavor. What I do disparage is the way that, and it's typically model developers talk, or their proponents talk about theories, which is mine is better than yours.
The fundamentalism is what you do.
Yeah, exactly. Mine has more empirical backing than yours or whatever. Yeah, and I'll go out, here's my kind of like risky statement. I do think that most of that is driven by ego and fiduciary interests.
Sure.
They're trying to sell their product.
Right.
And they have invested a lot in it. You know, they've based their career around it usually. And I just don't think it's helpful for the science of our field or for the training of our field. Mm. Like it's not, whenever our students go at Alliant where I teach, go to a training taught by, you know, by one of the big names, I always have to spend like an hour afterwards unwinding the dogma. Guys, no, it's not like if you aren't doing EFT, you're a horrible couples therapist.
Yeah,
like,
right.
What about all the couples therapy that happened before EFT? Was it crap? You know? Well, no, it's like, just keep it in perspective.
Yeah, for sure.
Anyway, I could go on about that forever.
Okay.
But I won't. Basically, you need to know a lot of theories so you can be able to adapt to the widest variety of clients. Some theories will not resonate with some people. And if all you have is a hammer, all of your clients have to be a nail. And your clients should not be the ones adapting to you. You should be the one adapting to them.
Okay. And next, you talk about client-centered. Say a little more. I know we all kind of know that term, but how do you conceptualize it?
Yeah. I conceptualize it in terms of a lot of the way that Milton Erickson talks about it. I've been diving into his work over the past several years and think, as do many people, that he was really a brilliant guy.
Right, right.
But being able to just really, really closely attune to a client's worldview, to their language, to how they work, how they make sense of things, what matters to them, what they value, what their cultural position is in the larger society where they live, what their socio-political reality is and how that might affect them. Basically, just the more deeply you empathize with the client and you can understand where they are, the more influence you are going to have in their life. That's it in a nutshell. And the risk is with doing therapy is we often do therapy to clients rather than with them. Or alongside them.
Right.
Yeah. And so just being really humble about where you are in that process, following their lead, and again, selecting an approach that resonates with them. And that sounds obvious, right? Like, well, yeah, of course. But it's in my personal experience, that's one of the hardest things to do. And it's very easy for me to get out of that rhythm and to lose the empathy and just go ahead with where I think things need to go.
Great.
Last thing on that point is if clients are going to improve, it will be through them marshaling their own resources and their internal resources. So
for sure.
We have to, like a therapist can help or hinder that process, but ultimately it's going to be the client that but takes what's offered and uses it to improve their lives.
Got it. So, yeah, you have me curious too about, you know, you brought up Milton Erickson, and he's just such an influential person. And so you've been drawn to his work kind of in this area?
I have, yeah. Been reading several books about him and by him, and it's been fascinating.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Next piece is Monitors Hope and the Therapeutic Alliance. How do we do that?
Yeah, this one is just a little more straightforward. Mm-hmm. Basically, one of the main engines of change is a client coming in and feeling like they are going, that it's going to work, right? Like, okay, I'm in the right place. And so part of being a common factors informed therapist is being mindful of that is one of the most kind of precious resources that exists in the therapy room, is the belief that this will help. And so Borden, from a long time ago in the late 70s, talked about you need to, in order to, for the alliance at least, a crucial part of the hope is the alliance, and that in order to have that, the alliance has three things. You have to be the goals. You have to be on the same page in relation to goals. We're headed in the same direction. Mm-hmm. You have to all agree that the tasks you're doing, the things you're doing in the room, will get you there. And you have to at least respect, if not like, each other. Mm-hmm. And if those things are there, chances are the hope is going to grow. And the effect of that is sort of exponential. And I will even say the hope can cover mistakes that you make as a therapist. I've had that happen a lot. Mm. One, for example, that I often talk about is back east when I was seeing a client, and they were, they'd been struggling working on some sexual abuse issues. And, she mentioned something, and I had this brilliant insight come to mind, and I'm like, great, here it is. And so I just let her, I'm like, just a second. And so I say this thing that I think is brilliant, and she's just listening, whatever. And I'm done. I'm like, what do you think? You know, certain that she's going to be just, you know, changed forever. And she said, actually, Sean, I didn't really hear what you said, but when you started talking, I thought of this thing. And then she explained to me what she was thinking, and what she had come up with was fantastic. It was really right where she needed to go. And all I had given her was time to think, you know? Yeah. So what was my point with that? My point with that being, you're going to make a lot of mistakes in therapy. Sure. And the therapy you think you're doing is not going to be the therapy you are doing a lot of the time.
That's a great point.
Other times I've had, if I'm at the end of therapy and it's been successful, and I'm asking them, you know, what do you remember from our work? What stuck out? And it's not uncommon for them to say, oh, when you said this, and whatever I said, they actually either misunderstood it or took it complete, like, it's not what I said. So, you know, some of my best work has been work I've never actually done.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
I think we've all had that experience, right?
Yeah, it's kind of the nature of the beast. And to me, the point of that is hope is what allows that to happen. Hope is kind of the magic that sort of overlooks all of our mistakes, or smooths over all of our mistakes. Hmm. So keep monitoring that. The ways you can, there are a lot of different methods. Of course, Scott Miller has a lot of good stuff out there.
Yeah.
With his work in terms of monitoring the alliance. For families, there are fewer options. The STIC, it's called, STIC. Mm-hmm. It's an abbreviation for Systemic Therapy Inventory of Change, out of Northwestern. Can do it. It's a little long, and, you know, takes some work, but that's an option. And also just plain old asking them, getting in the habit of checking in, you know, how are things going? Are you getting what you need?
Exactly. Yeah. And you also, you mentioned mistakes, and I don't know where you talk about it in the article. I was actually looking for it, but you do highlight the importance of that there's going to be rupture and it needs to be repaired, and it needs to be repaired promptly. And that's something I just gave a talk on that recently, the AFTA conference. And it's something I'm very interested in as well, mm-hmm. where traditional rupture and repair ideas were around, you know, if we don't get defensive, right? If they bring up something, we don't get defensive. But the reality is that we need to be ahead of that, I think. You know, we need to take the lead kind of and know and pay attention to when those ruptures are happening. And I was wondering what you had to say about that, because you did highlight it as really important repairing as mistakes are made.
That's a really good point. Yeah, I think if we are tuned in as therapists to the relationship, we can often sense when it has gone wrong off, or we can pick up on clues that maybe it has, like if they're showing up late or if there's more cancellations than usual, whatever it is.
Right.
And I think it's on us. I agree with you 100%. It's on us to bring it up and to at least put it out there as, hey, last session was pretty rough. In reflecting on it, I wish I would have done this differently or that differently.
Right.
Or, hey, I don't think I really heard you very well last time. Or maybe I jumped to some conclusions, and I just wanted to touch base with that.
Yeah, that's great. Okay. Your next point is an interesting one. You view clients as people rather than objects. Say more.
This is the one I get most excited about lately. Hmm. And I wrote an article we published it in JMFT a few years ago. Some colleagues of mine, all just on this, and we're in the process of writing another one. But I think if you go back to our alien friend again, who's down here to learn about therapy, I think, and just my own experience in life, I respond better to people that see me and that care about me, and that I can feel that they do. And I think that is far and away the most important aspect of therapy and the one thing that we can bring. And, you know, as an aside here, we're hearing a lot lately, or I'm hearing a lot at least, this fear that machines will replace therapists.
Right.
And I think machines might replace bad therapists, which would be probably a good thing. But I don't, the one thing a machine can never give is that I, as a human being, Sean Davis, am sitting here of my own free will and choice, listening to you describe your life. And you can tell that I really do genuinely care. Like, your hurt matters to me. I want it to stop. I want you to feel better. Like, that human element, I think, is, again, the juice that makes this whole thing work. I think that's more important than here's another vulnerability, but like the science of our field, or if anything, I think what we're doing is primarily a human interaction. And the more human it is, the more effective and the more powerful you are. If I could tell a story on this one too.
Sure.
When this principle was first illustrated to me, it was in my master's program, and there was one professor we had who was on this principle brilliant, like one of these types where even if you just sit down next to them on a park bench, like you feel good.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
I don't know if you've ever met someone like that. They just feel good. And so this professor had a reputation for this. And so I went into her office one day for supervision, individual supervision. Her name was Leslie. And she turned around. She was typing emails. She turned around. She looks at me. She's like, "How are you doing?" I said, "Good, Leslie. Yeah, things are going well." And then she took a breath and she looked at me and she said, "Sean, how are you doing?" And I really was feeling good, I thought. But when she said that, I burst into tears. And all this stuff that I'd been that had been down in there that I wasn't even aware of legitimately all came just flooding out. And, blah, 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 and I don't even remember what I said, but I do remember crying for what seemed like forever. And then when I was done, I look up and dry my eyes, and she's just sitting there with me and listening. And I said, "Wow." And I felt really great at that point. And I was like, "Leslie, how do you do that?" She's like, "How do you do what?" And I'm like, no. None of this therapist, like, you tell me, like, give me an answer. How did you just do what you did? I thought I was feeling great. Clearly I wasn't. You knew that. And just with a few words, like, I'm, you know, pouring out my heart. How do you do that? She wouldn't tell me. She's like, "Oh, I don't know. I don't know what you mean." And I'm like, "Knock it off. Of course you know what I mean." So I'm pretty persistent. And all semester, I'm like, "Leslie, you've got to tell me." She won't tell me. And at the end of the semester, and I still have a year left in the program, I said, "Leslie, I'm a persistent guy. I'm not leaving you alone until you give me something. And what do you do that is that?" And she said, "Okay, Sean, fine. The problem is you're asking the wrong question." She said, "Therapeutic isn't something you do. It's something you are." And that really, of course, then in my mind, you know, she like just apparates up into heaven or whatever. That really kind of like stuck with me and has had a huge impact on me. And it has changed everything of the way I think about theory is and therapy and this whole enterprise we're involved in. It's much more about who we are than about what we do.
That's great. Wonderful. Thanks for the story. Yeah.
And the article goes into, and especially the one I wrote a few years ago with my friends, what that means to see someone as a person rather than an object. Because we all say, "Well, of course I see people as people rather than objects." But when you really tease it down, tease it apart, that's probably not true for a huge chunk of the world.
Well, and would you say, this is me being a little critical, would you say that our training programs objectify clients in particular ways and we're having to undo that a little bit these days?
Yeah, sure. You know, your borderline client or your whatever. And our society that we're in now is, you know, a lot of people are making a lot of money off of their objectification of entire chunks of the population.
For sure.
Thank
you for that. And that's, I hope, I'm glad that people got to hear that story. Okay, the final principle is something I think is really important and interesting, and I like that you prioritize it. And this is the idea that you prioritize healing over therapy. And can you say more?
Yes. I'm hoping that this is one of the principles that gets some, that stirs people up a little or gets us talking.
For sure.
As a field. I am, and this, again, if we circle back to the alien observer metaphor, and let's say this alien is looking at healing over, you know, from day one, whatever that was.
Right.
People have been seeking out rituals. They've been seeking external help for coping with their challenges for eons, you know, for long before, I say in the article, Freud bought his first couch.
Right.
And so to me, and yet the way we often conduct therapy and write about it and think about it is that we have the corner on healing. And I simply don't think we do. I think that's pretty myopic, pretty arrogant. And so I am a big proponent of looking for inspiration for our work, wherever we can find it. And that's what the people who founded, I'm talking about family therapy, who founded family therapy did. Like, if you read their work, there's a ton of stuff from like biology, yeah, from, you know, medicine, philosophy,
anthropology,
linguistic, yeah, anthropology. Mm-hmm. Exactly. I've been reading a lot of Jung lately as well. And I think this is fascinating. He will write entire chapters and books on, you know, him living with the Aborigines of whatever. He'll go and like live with Aboriginal cultures, and a lot of their kind of mystic and spiritual beliefs heavily informed his work and his writing. Mm-hmm. You could not get away with that now and be taken seriously. And I think that is a problem, and that's to our detriment. So in my mind, a common factors therapist is open to learning about healing wherever it occurs, and is constantly asking, how can I marshal the resources in my client's life, or help them marshal the resources, I should say, to better access whatever healing opportunities they have available to them. You know, maybe that's through their faith, maybe that's through their community or tradition, cultural tradition, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. I also have a thing. A buddy of mine, Dr. Jason Platt, is down in Mexico City, and he and I for years have been taking people down to a little village called Malinalco in Mexico. Mm-hmm. And we have a lady down there. She's an indigenous healer, kind of a mystical, and she will lead us through a lot of different indigenous healing practices from the native tribes down there. And it's fascinating, both in terms of their impact that they have on us. I can't tell you how many people have come out of, we'll do a Temescal, which is where you go in and it's like a sweat lodge. Mm-hmm. And you go in and people have come out of there just racking, their bodies racking with sobs, as they've kind of, you know, as they're working through stuff that it has plagued them forever. Mm-hmm. And so then we always have really interesting conversations about what is this, you know, what does this mean about healing in general? And so anyway, bottom line with this principle is, don't be so arrogant to think that we are the only one helping people, and learn about healing wherever it exists and use it to inform what you do within kind of the ethical constraints of our field.
Awesome. Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you, Sean. But before I let you go, I got two more questions. And the one I've been like asking lately is, and you've already brought up, you know, you're reading Milton Erickson, you're reading Jung. But one of the question I like to ask is like, what ideas, what books, film, whatever is kind of catching your attention these days? What's influencing you?
I recently finished reading a book called My Voice Will Go With You, by Rosen. It's a book about Milton Erickson. It's just his teaching tales. Fascinating. Mm. Right now on my bedstand, and this might say more about me than here, might explain why my sleeping problems, but and I've been accused of being a nerd, probably rightfully so, but on my bedstand is The Language of Change. By Václavic. I think the original Václavic, Jackson, those guys from the MRI group are fascinating. I find their ideas about communication brilliant. I read There's a book I read recently about nature, Jung's, it was a compilation of all of Jung's different treatises on nature. Hmm. I've been long interested and have written a few articles on the role of nature in our well-being.
Yeah.
So those are the main things.
That's great. Thank you. And if people want to get a hold of you, how do they get a hold of you? I think you have I just saw you post something. You have a workshop coming up in Sacramento, or how do people find you? Yeah.
Yeah. The best way on Facebook, I have a Sean Davis PhD professional page. That's the easiest way. I have a website, thedavisgroup.org. You can email me, drdavis@thedavisgroup.org, or sdavis@alliant.edu. Those are the best ways. And I'm out and about. I teach a class on how to start a private practice. And then I talk about common factors a lot as here and there around the country. But the best way to stay up to date with my trainings are from my website, thedavisgroup.org.
That's great. And for anybody up in Northern California area, some of our folks, like my private practice supervisees, went to Sean's workshop, really loved it. So I can speak for that. So if you get a chance, go. So, all right.
Great to have. I also do trainings down in that Mexico thing I was just talking about.
Oh, yeah, the writer's retreat, right?
Yeah, the writer's retreat. We recently opened that up to everyone. It used to just be for Alliance students, but now it's for everyone. So that's my favorite thing of all that I do.
I might have to try that one of these days.
Yeah,
keep doing it. Yeah. Okay, Sean, thank you very much for taking the time and for being our first repeat guest. And I love talking about this stuff. And so thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Chris. It's an honor. Appreciate it.
Yep. All right, that's our show. And as always, thanks for listening. For those of you that made it this far and are wondering what podcasts I might listen to around theory, because I am a theory freak. A couple I really like are the podcast titled Why Theory with Ryan Engley, and I think it's Scott McGowan. I'm drawing a blank on his name. I want to say Scott McGowan. And also Peter Rollins. I like Peter Rollins' work. He's a psychoanalytic philosopher, writer, theologian. And he does a kind of a podcast with a comedian friend called The Fundamentalists. And they get into some interesting ideas and make theory kind of user friendly. So a couple of you might want to check out Why Theory and Peter Rollins' The Fundamentalists. Both I listen to regularly. So there's my confession. Anyway. Come find us on social media. The Radical Therapist is on Instagram. We have a Radical Therapist Facebook page. We have a website. I have an email at theradicaltherapist@gmail.com. And I know people have emailed me, and I'm going to get back to you. I promise I will get back to you. life has been a little busy these days, so I will get back to you. But come find us on social media. Be part of the community. Love to know you're out there. So please do that. And that's all I got. So, as always, my name is Dr. Chris Hoff. This has been the Radical Therapist Podcast. Thanks for listening.